No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Marilia, how are you?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you? It's nice to hear you, even though I've just seen you this week.
Yeah, I know. We had lunch together. It was great. At the Democratic Club.
Yes.
You know, I forgot to tell you, you know, sometimes they give you a test when you walk in, and they forgot to give you a heads up. And if they ask you who the greatest president in American history was, you can't say like Ronald Reagan or somebody you win. You have to say, you know, Franklin Roosevelt or John F. Kennedy or somebody.
Well, I'm glad they didn't ask me because I failed.
It's because you
wouldn't have eaten.
You're looking more like a Democrat these days. So they weren't suspect.
Well, I've always been a leading part.
They're also preoccupied with trying to figure out whether you've been vaccinated or not, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It made him forget.
Yeah, I had to go back to my car and get my vaccination certificate. Anyway, tonight we're supposed to have the Reverend Jesse Jackson on the show, and we will attempt to continue to hook up with him. We couldn't get him. We tried him earlier, and we couldn't. His cell phone wasn't answering, so we'll try him through the course of the show, and if we can't get him, we'll just have to reschedule for another time. We apologize to our listening audience for anybody that's tuning in to listen to the Reverend Jackson. We may have to reschedule him. You know, sometimes these things come up when you're doing live radio. Somebody's in the middle of something, or something came up that nobody expected, or, you know, or they're stuck in a snowstorm on 95 and they can't, you know. Whatever the case may be. So we'll keep on trying. We'll keep on trying him, and hopefully he'll come on at some point during the show. But go ahead, Marilia.
No, I just said, indeed. I know there is snow in Pennsylvania right now. I know somebody who is battling his way through coming south, and it's adding like 2 hours.
Is that right?
Yeah,
that's where Mrs. Brown is right now. She's in... She's outside of Wilmington right now in Pennsylvania. Yeah, Pat's there. But she's not due to come home until tomorrow. So hopefully she'll have clear weather.
Yes, she'll get better, I saw.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's gotten really crazy, you know. First of all, you know, here in Washington, right, we get 2 inches of snow and it's like, a disaster.
Yeah.
I don't know why that is. I don't know why we've never learned to drive in the snow. I've heard some people say it's because the snow here is really slick. The warmer temperatures cause a kind of a layer of ice to come under the snow. So it's really slick conditions. I think it's because none of us know how to drive.
I think that's true. Too many people who are of all walks of life in terms of national, international, and have perhaps not seen snow before too, because Washington is such a cosmopolitan city, so many people don't probably have ever been exposed to driving in it. So perhaps that's part of it.
Well, and you know, it was never meant to have automobiles in it. You know, you've got these wide, beautiful boulevards like Pennsylvania Avenue and Massachusetts Avenue, and then we have all these traffic circles. I don't know whose crazy idea that was. L'Enfant, I guess.
Yeah, it was a Frenchman.
Huh?
It was the Frenchman.
Yeah, it was the Frenchman, exactly. As Mark Twain would say, Frenchmen are at the root of all evil. But it was designed by the same guys that designed Paris. So, you know, Charles Dickens came to Washington. A lot of people don't know this, but Dickens was a newspaper columnist, among other things, you know, and he wrote a thing called The City of Great Intentions, you know, that he made fun of D.C., because we had such wide boulevards and it was such a pretty city and nobody lived here at the time. You know, it was just like we built this city, you know, we built it under the if you build it, they will come philosophy, and they hadn't quite come yet. So, you know, he called it the City of Great Intentions. And it really is a beautiful city, and it was built to be, you know, to try to intimidate heads of state, you know, that it was made to be beautiful in order to try to give us a home court advantage when in the days when international politics was handled, you know, firsthand in Paris and London and right. Rome and D.C. But
he did say that this was not the republic he came to see.
Yes.
He thought it was literally a marsh.
Yes.
And a moral swamp, which, you know, back then, if he said that back then, imagine what he'd say now.
Oh, my gosh, such a moral swamp, you know. And yeah. It's politics is such a it's such an honorable thing to do if you do it right, you know. Yeah. Do it with understanding that you're responsible for the people, to the people that elect you, and not just responsible to yourself.
Right. You know? Right. Jack Kemp used to say he used to joke about being a public servant as opposed to a public serpent.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, now you can say these people are more public serpents than servants, because it is not in the classical definition of a public servant. Yeah. That I, when I was working in government, but it's funny because Dickens back then, when he went to visit Congress, he found lawmakers were partisan and uncivil, which is amazing if you compare that to what it is now. For him to have said that then.
Well, you know what? Politics has really, I think that people don't understand this sometimes, but American politics has always been kind of dirty. You know, I think of Andrew Jackson, who, you know, Andrew Jackson is a great story in that his wife died of a heart attack just prior to him being installed as president. He held the press responsible for this, because they called his wife an adulterer. His wife had been married to her cousin for one day. She had an arranged marriage to her cousin for one day, which they never consummated. And she got, and it was annulled, but yet his opposition used it against him and called her an adulterer. And she died of a heart attack, and he held the press responsible for that. And actually, he had a bawdy barmaid for a niece. I forget what her name was, but he used to bring her to all the White House functions just because it annoyed the Washington elite. people like Dolly Madison, it drove him crazy that she, that his official escort to White House functions would be this woman that served beer in a local, you know, in a local pub and was usually popping out of whatever clothing she was wearing. And, you know, things that were said about Thomas Jefferson, and I mean, they said horrible things about each other, and they're still doing it.
And of course, the British Parliament, that's what you see. It's well, in the past, it was unlike it was here, but it's pretty good watching prime minister's questions and the debate on the floor because of the British Parliament, because it is different from here. Here you have this formality and will the gentleman this and the lady that, whatever. But I think it's deteriorating a little bit, but it's still not like that. But in England.
You know what? Since you brought it up, what do you think of all this stuff with the prime minister? What do you think of this, of people calling on him to resign because he had a party? Do you think that's extreme? I mean, I feel like Trump had all these parties in the White House, and yes, we said the same sort of things, but nobody called on him to resign, you know.
Well, I think there were bigger things for him to resign over, number one.
Well, that's...
You know, much bigger things than that. But by then, lying was pretty much the currency of this White House, and it had started to become normalized, as it has been fully, I think, now. But Boris Johnson lied about those parties, and I think that that was the kernel in that whole debate, was his lying about it, and increasingly more and more things come out. And of course, they have the Queen, who is such a moral compass, as a background to compare what he was doing against what she had been doing after the death of her husband. So I think that gave it more of a contrast.
Well, you know, that's true, and it's often been said here too about Watergate, that if Nixon hadn't lied about it, that it might have been a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
It might have, you know, turned out a whole different way. And as I said to you the other day, I worked at the DNC right after that. And if you wanted to know the secrets of the DNC, all you had to do was go take the paper jam out of the Xerox machine. You know, we didn't have any security of any sort. You know, anybody could walk in. It really was the height of paranoia with those people, because the DNC in those days was much like the Boy Scouts. They meant well, but they weren't a particularly powerful organization. So,
right.
You know, if he hadn't lied. But, you know, we're still trying to get Reverend Jackson, if we can. But, you know, I want to ask him, one of the things that I found really unusual in scanning the news this week is mm-hmm. that Joe Biden's approval rating for Uniting America is 24%. That's pretty dismal.
It is.
And, you know, I don't know, as a Democrat, what we do about that. You know, it seems so hard, especially in light of this recent push, for example, on voting rights in the Senate, where it's gone strictly along partisan lines, for us to bring America together. It's a scary thought that we may not be able to do this.
And I don't think that it's attributed to Biden. I think it is the zeitgeist right now. There is just no pleasing anybody. There is a very divided citizenship. People are not happy with each other. There was a poll that I read about today, I forget where they asked Republicans and Democrats, young Republicans and young Democrats, would you date somebody of the opposite party? And the vast majority on both sides said no. So what does that say?
Is that right?
Yeah. And that's pathetic. So what does that say? And the thing I always think about whenever I see this, and it's something that I've always battled with myself when I started, when I made my entree, when I journeyed into politics, sort of unintentionally, having come from the science world. And I think I remember telling you, because you were getting your master's in political science, and I was going to go into my PhD program, and I would joke with you and say, "What? Where is the science in politics? There's no science in politics." And indeed, this is something that really, it doesn't bother me so much. I struggle with it because I look at everything with the lens of science, and that is, you have to have an experiment with a control, and you have to control the different variables to come up with something that's statistically significant and statistically pure. And you don't get that in politics. So when you say, or when, you know, when the polls say, I should say, not you say, that his approval rating right now in terms of bringing people together is 24%, I think of 1,000 variables that you can play that up against that will point to it not having anything to do with President Biden.
Well, you know, and the fact that you use the word experiment, you know, I think a lot of people forget that that's what democracy was in the first place, you know. These guys, I mean, you know, when you look at the founding of the nation, guys read a handful of books. They read, you know, Wealth of Nations and The Social Contract and Two Treatises of Government, you know, this handful of books that intellectuals had put out. And there was this very small cadre that came up with this idea that the power could come from the people. That was really, really kind of a radical idea. And it was an experiment. Yep. And it's one of the things that really has cost the District of Columbia, because when they decided to create the government, they weren't really sure how rule by the people would work. So they didn't give women a vote because they were property. They didn't give African Americans a vote. They didn't give Native Americans a vote. And they didn't give the people of District Columbia a vote because they were worried about not being able to control things. You know, of course, thank God, all these other groups have been brought back in. But D.C. still hanging out there. And I got to tell you, I've got an editorial that's going to appear online in the Washington Post next week.
Oh, great.
Because I'm annoyed that everybody in America is talking about voting rights, and we're not talking about the 700,000 disenfranchised people who live right here in the nation's capital. It's just crazy to me.
It is. It's a bigger population than the state of Wyoming, which has two senators and a wonderful congresswoman, Lynn Cheney.
Yeah.
But it's a bigger population than the state of Wyoming.
How about that? A wonderful Republican congresswoman. You know, there are a handful of them left. But it seems to me that when you were involved in politics, there were many more. Were Republicans that I respected, even Republicans I didn't agree with, Bob Dole, Lowell Weicker. I could go on and on. Even people like Barry Goldwater, who I don't know that I ever agreed with anything that Barry Goldwater had to say. But you know what? He was saying the same thing on his last day in office as he was on his first day in office. He had a set of beliefs and he stuck to them. Now these guys, it seems to me, do everything on the basis of a popularity poll.
It is so true. And just getting reelected, and I just don't get it. I really don't understand that. Even John Kasich said the other day, why do you need to get reelected? Is it really because of the pension that you're going to get having served just one term? Is it really because of the health care that you're going to get forever just because you serve one term and you want more? And the power, I guess, having more terms speaks to power. Absolutely. And it speaks to accumulating the power and the capital, no pun intended, to get more capital. Because, you know, it is a revolving door in Washington. And I think that's what these people look for. But there has to be more to life than being in Congress.
Well, and you know what? It just amazes me that it causes that in turn causes things on both sides in terms of like in Virginia, they have a one term limit for governor.
Now, yeah, that's right.
What sense does that make? You know, you're just learning the job after your first term. But, you know, but people believe, you know, if you get ensconced, that's a problem. And you know, that if you think about this in other terms, it really does seem crazy. Imagine going to a doctor after 4 years and saying, well, you practiced for 4 years and now we think you should give somebody else a chance.
That is a great comparison. And yeah. And you're getting all your ducks in a row. You're not just learning. It's not just the learning curve, but getting everything together as a governor, even with 4 years. You're getting the coalitions. You're getting people support to enact things or to change regulations or whatever. And it takes time.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it needs reform. We need a new contract with America.
Yeah, it's not funny. But we do.
We need to something like that to galvanize people.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I don't know what that is exactly. Oh, wait a second. I got a call coming in. Maybe we're here. Yes, hello. Yeah. Hello? Yeah. Any luck? Okay, thank you. Well, seems like we're not going to have Reverend Jackson.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, it's a shame. Hopefully we'll be able to reschedule him. Again, I apologize to anybody that's tuned in to hear him. We didn't get any notification that he wouldn't be on the show, so we assumed he would be here. But let me point out that he's 80 years old and that, you know, things happen, especially when you're 80 years old. So we hope that everything's okay with him. And we hope that we can have him back. One thing that I really wanted to ask him is that in 1984 at the convention, he gave a keynote speech at the Democratic convention. He was under a lot of fire because he referred to New York as Heimy Town. He called Jews Heimies. And of course the Jewish community was apoplectic about it. You know, it was a horrible racial slur that he had used in haste. And he came out, and this is God's honest truth, because I was on the floor of the convention when this happened. He came out and people booed him. Jews from all over. You can imagine how many Jewish people are in the Democratic Party and are at the Democratic Convention. Jews and other people, too, booed him for those remarks. By the end of his speech, those same people that booed him stood up and gave him a standing ovation for what he had said, for the apologies that he had made, for the forgiveness he had asked for. And that was one thing that I really wanted to ask him was the president's approval rating so low for uniting the country. What are the words that we need to use to unite us? They escape me. I try to find them, but I don't know what they are. I think that we need to focus on being Americans. That used to be something, didn't it? That you were an American, didn't it? I mean, weren't there things you could say, Marilli, about other Americans that you knew to be true, that we all love our country, we all love freedom, we all love, you know, there were certain values that we all shared. What's happened? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
We've gotten to the point where there are organizations out there that fight for this. There are programs out there. There are, in fact, two actors, Chris Evans and Mark Casson, I think, who have an online sort of podcasty thing where they are trying to bring the two sides together. But people don't know this. It gets lost in the snowstorm of what's available online in terms of newspapers, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, you name it, and podcasts. But I don't think that's going to bring people together. I don't think that's going to be the sort of catalyst for a cross conversation. I don't know what will, but I think it will come in the form of a leader, a huge leader that we need, somebody who can galvanize people, somebody who can set an example without the outcry of the opposite party, even before they begin.
Are you saying what I think you're saying, that there needs to be a Mike and Marilia for president and vice president in 2024? Actually, it would be more likely Marilia and Mike. But
No, I can't because I wasn't born here.
Oh, damn. All right, right. I'll do it. All right.
Yeah, right. You'll have to take the sword.
Yeah. Oh, you couldn't be vice president either, right? Because then if somebody bumps me off, which surely somebody would, most likely Mrs. Brown, then you have to be able to take. That is kind of, I wonder if that's something that will ever change. You know,
I wonder about that too, because at one point I imagine there will be a majority of people who have not been born here.
Yeah, and you know, especially people like you. How old were you when you emigrated to the United States?
I was almost nine, about.
So, you know, so you've been here for almost 20 years now.
Exactly. You know, I always admire your arithmetic skills, Mike.
Yeah, that's why I went into science. I'm such a good counter, you know. I've got to tell you, only because you brought this up, I hate to digress, but math was always my worst subject, you know, and my next door neighbor was a Marine colonel who had a degree in mathematics when I was a kid, had a degree in mathematics from someplace like MIT. Uh-huh. And he said to my parents, because my mother said, Michael's really bad at math. Now I'm not even in middle school yet. I think I'm still in elementary school or just starting middle school. And Colonel Horseman says, that's okay, because I can teach Michael math. I can teach math to anybody. And he tutored me for about a month. And then he came to my mother and he said, I was wrong. I can't teach math to everybody. I don't get it, you know, because I was a salesman very early on in life, and I could calculate percentages and stuff in my head very quickly because they were all connected with commissions, right? I knew if I sold you something for $1,100, I knew exactly what my commission would be. So simple math I was always good at, but I just never. Oh, yes. Okay, great. Reverend Jackson, thank you for being on the show.
How are you, my brother? How are you?
I'm good, and we so much appreciate it. And for our listeners out there, this is a person that needs no introduction, a formidable civil rights leader, colleague of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement in the South ever since he was in college, ran for president twice. I'm proud to say, Reverend Jackson, that I worked with Mal Warwick. I had a consulting firm, and I worked with on your presidential campaign in 1984 with Mal Warwick from San Francisco. And I'm very proud of that. You got 21% of the primary vote and 29% of the primary vote in 1988. We know that the great Shirley Chisholm is very often spoken of as the first nominee of a party for president, African-American nominee, but you certainly were the first really, really credible one. And we're happy to have you on the show. And of course, you were the first United States Senator for the district.
Sure, did a great job. She broke the ice.
Yes, she was an amazing person. So, Marilia, do you have a question for the Reverend?
Hello, Reverend Jackson. It's such a pleasure to meet you on
How
air.
Are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
God bless you.
So, thank you. Mike was saying that your impressive 1984 third place in the primary, and in 1988 you ran again, got another impressive 29% behind Dukakis. So with that behind you and everything else you've accomplished, what is it that motivated you to run for shadow senator?
Well, it's a dignity, really. D.C. is qualified to be a state. It has the enough people, enough economy, and all makes up a state. It has distinct territory. I would have been infringed upon by Virginia and Maryland, but it is the state should be represented directly and indirectly. So I felt the need to run for D.C. statehood, since it was make D.C. statehood an issue on the ballot.
Well, let me ask you, Reverend, I've been told by many of the people that worked with you on that in those days that when you had the position, you were more of an activist than we are today.
Yeah.
I know you and Reverend Barber just got arrested in front of the Capitol protesting the Senate's inability to pass voting rights legislation. So why do you think there was more activism back then than there is now on this particular issue? Do you have any feeling on that?
Because I acted. I felt that was my obligation to act, make visible the plight of D.C. citizens. More people than seven states pay more taxes than about 10 at that time states. Most of them in Vietnam, percentage-wise, in almost any state in the country. So we paid enough taxes, we worked enough, we bled enough, and died enough. Deserves to be represented by ourselves in the state government, federal government.
And how important is activism? What does activism do for the movement? Does it provide it with energy? You know, I look towards the civil rights movement in the South and the things that you guys did, you and Reverend King and the other people that were involved in the movement in the South. What is it about activism that's important to us? You know, because what we do here, Reverend, is we go up and we try to explain to Congress why it's okay for us to be a state. And I think they all know that it's okay for us to be a state, but we're not very, you know, we don't, I've been arrested, but we don't do that much anymore. How important is that?
Well, I'm going to visit every senator. They gave me an appointment, all 100 of them, and begin to look at what was the agenda they had and what our needs were. And there's a crisis. You pull people together, tell them you must the short-term problem. Solution is X. If we're going to say this, Y and Z. It depends on the leadership.
Well, you know that I just mentioned this on the show just before you came on, but in 1984, I stood in San Francisco on the floor of the convention, and I heard you give a speech. I heard you give a speech that when you first came out on the stage, there were people that booed you, and when you left, those same people stood and applauded for you. It was one of the most amazing speeches I've ever heard and one of the most amazing reactions I've ever seen. Now, with America so divided and President Biden with a 24% approval rating on bringing Americans together, what do you think we need to say? What are those things we need to say to bring people together?
He deserves a better rating than that. For example, the pandemic, which is worldwide, killing almost 1 million Americans and many people around the world, inherited that situation. The hostility of Trump and his people, willing to overthrow the government if they can, second insurrection, one 1861, she kicked up Civil War and this one here. So no matter what he does, I've seen people who had toothache chewing ice and picking their dentist. That's Trump. You're stupid. That's absurd, you know? So I think that he has done a good job. There are more people working. There's a better atmosphere in Washington today.
Oh, yeah.
Speech he gave, I think he gave a little too much too late. But I think that we have to make it the last time ourselves. If we set the climate, we have a friend who will help us.
Is he doing enough for black people? Are black people still part of the Biden coalition? Will they be there in 2022?
I hope they will, because the alternative is Trump. That's unacceptable. Mm. Fascism. So we deserve better than that. I saw Senator Dallaran when he was Humphrey. But Johnson was eliminated. We ended up getting Nixon. So I thought, we shouldn't do the Dallaran. We should put forth our agenda. Fighting for it, march for it, but don't assume that anything is better than what we got. It's not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Aurelia, you have anything?
Brown.
Yes.
Right, I got to go, buddy. Okay.
Okay. Reverend, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your time. We appreciate your service to America. And let me tell you that I'm honored to be a shadow. I'm honored to be a United States Senator from the District of Columbia, following in your footsteps, I hope. Thank you.
Indeed.
Let me say to all of you who listen tonight, I need to join the Rainbow, make the Rainbow a strong organization. Multiracial, multicultural, rainbowpush.org, rainbowpush.org. Accept my membership, okay?
Yep,
thank you, Michael.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend.
Well, it was nice to get a few words in from the Reverend. Obviously, he didn't feel like he could stay with us very long. You know, like I say, he's 80 years old, and we appreciate that he took time to come and talk to us. So
that was really, really kind.
Yeah.
And accomplished so much. You think, gosh, how do you stand on top of his accomplishments and still stand tall and strong with all that he's been through? He was then Martin Luther King. We can't forget that.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago, and a lot of strife and a lot of fighting and a lot of stress.
Yeah, and things have changed so much. You know, now that you bring that up, I used to do consulting work for a guy named Fritz Hollings.
Oh, my God.
Fritz was the youngest governor in the history of America. He was the governor of South Carolina. And when I worked for him, he was a United States senator.
Mm-hmm.
But Jackson used to come to things Senator Hollings would be there, and he would remind people that even though that they were colleagues and they were friends, when Jackson graduated from high school and Fritz was governor, mm-hmm. he kept Jackson from having his picture taken in front of the Capitol because African-American students weren't allowed to do that in those days. Can you imagine that?
That's just gobsmacking, isn't it? I mean, I can't see that from Hollings, even though he is, but certainly Thurmond. I mean, he was a Dixiecrat.
Yeah, and right, and it was, you know, they did it. I don't know what it. Yeah, I don't know. In Hollings, I agree with you. I don't think that was his heart, but
right,
you know,
right.
That's what people thought. In you know, it's interesting if you study the evolution of the District of Columbia and how it became you know, came into existence and how it was governed, you'll see that after the Civil War, the Republicans made a really, really strong effort in Washington, D.C. to bring African Americans to Washington, D.C., and to bestow rights on them. There's a book called A Lesson for All the Land by Kate Mazur, which outlines the fact that Republicans allowed freed slaves to do all sorts of interesting things in Washington that they weren't really allowed to do other places. Form social clubs, you know, have certain jobs. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I just interject? There are some incredible former residents of Georgetown who were doctors, bankers. In fact, there was a very famous slave, and they have a house in Georgetown, which is exactly where his house was. He was like the first homeowner, and he was a banker. His name was Yaro Mamut, and you can read all about him in the Georgetown Library. So you're absolutely right. They were allowed to do these things, and it just amazes me. There was another one in Georgetown who was an MD. He actually had an office on 27th Street. And saw patients. And it's just mind-boggling to me, because that was in coexisting with slaves at that time.
Well, you know, but what also came of that was the idea that they didn't believe they were allowed to have social clubs and be professionals, but they didn't believe that white people and black people should be in the same social clubs.
Right.
They believed in segregation. And that really set the kind of informally set the stage for what was to take place for the next 100 years. The separate but equal thing here in Washington, D.C., we kind of invented separate but equal. And it wasn't until the Brown versus Board of Education, of course, that was knocked down by the Supreme Court. And by the way, we should just add that one of the plaintiffs in the case was a girl that was a student here in Washington, D.C. So, if you study the history of Washington, you will find the history of America. It's very interesting how things developed here. And now we have a city that, you know, we're the most liberal. You know, it drives me nuts that we don't have voting representation, as you well know. Yeah. But, I mean, is it because of what we do, Marilia, because of what you do and what I do and all the people of Washington, D.C., so many of us do, isn't this like telling the people of Detroit they can't drive cars, or saying to people in L.A. you can't go to the movies? You can make the movies, but you just can't go watch them. You know, it's just crazy, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, and you know, and we need everybody out there to stand up. It's been annoying me, and I got to tell you, the Democrats are right up there annoying me with the Republicans, because the Democrats are treating us, our disenfranchised status, as if it doesn't, you know, it's some dirty little secret that they don't want to talk about when they're talking about voting rights. Mm-hmm. They talk about two voting rights bills that are before the United States Senate right now, the Right to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. But there's also a third piece of legislation, which, like the other two pieces of legislation, have passed the United States House of Representatives and is in the Senate with 47 co-sponsors, and that's the D.C. Washington D.C. Admission Act, which would make us a state and would enfranchise, as Reverend Jackson points out, more people than there are in two states, Wyoming and Vermont. And and Jackson was the senator, as he pointed out, there were 10 states that had the same population as D.C. Mm-hmm. At one time, the population of D.C. was 850,000. So it's gone down over the years. It's been going back up several years. But at one point, it was 850,000. And that's another thing that people don't, you know, one of the other little nuances of our involuntary servitude is that even when it comes from president, we don't have an equal vote. Because when we're 850,000, we should have four electoral votes. but we only got three based on population, but we only got three because the Constitutional Amendment, 23rd Amendment, which establishes our right to vote for president, as amazing as that is, we didn't have a right to vote for president, says that we can have no more votes than that of the smallest state. So no matter, you know, even if we had a population of 10 million, we would still only have three electoral votes. So, you know, we got to stop this nonsense, man. We've got more veterans. We have 30,000 veterans who have served their country. And I don't know how we say to them that they can't have the same rights as somebody who lives in Maryland or Virginia who's never served. I just don't know how we can do that in good conscience.
I don't understand either. And there's been big push, not least of which has been by you, and for many years, and nothing gets done. It is, as they say, political. And yeah. Somebody is gaining from this. Somebody in power is gaining from this, as you know.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know. I mean, we say it all the time, but Frederick Douglass said it. That power can seize nothing without a demand, never, and it never will. And what we do is we don't demand. We send our two most compromised people up to Capitol Hill to lobby. We send the mayor and the chairman of the city council. Now, these are people that need to ask the federal government for $800 million a year. And they also understand that ultimately, Congress has control of the city. So, you know, we live in their house, basically. So, you know, I ask you, how tough would you be with me if you lived in my house and I gave you $800 million a year? You know, I mean, what would you say to me? Right. If you don't do this for me, I swear I'm going to not let you give me any more money anymore. You know, I mean, what? Right? We need somebody to make a demand. We don't. We go up there and we try to convince them that this is okay. We say the Constitution doesn't say anything about taking our right to representation away. They know that. They all know that. We don't need to keep on telling it. Right. They know that. It's all about partisan politics. And Tom Davis, we had him on last week, and I asked him this. Yeah. Is, you know, he said to me one time, there's only two things you can do to a politician. You can either help them or you can hurt them. So we can't help anybody because we don't have a vote. We can't help. No, you can't. That's why Eleanor Holmes Norton is so amazing, is because she has nothing to trade and she still gets things done. But, you know, I can't vote for your, coal bill, Senator Manchin, if you vote for my statehood bill, because I got no vote. But, we need to find a way to hurt them. We need to, West Virginia is really close, and we need to get 10,000 people to go over there and protest and say, Joe, remember you're a Democrat. You know?
Right.
I mean, I don't
change his mind, though. And what me is, you know, the Congress criticizes the way the district has been run. And I have to say that I do agree with it being the recipient of the lack of services or the poor services, although it must be said they have improved since the days of Marion Barry. Wouldn't you think that they would think, okay, if they're allowed into the, quote, big league of Congress with the right, you know, with statehood, don't you think that it would probably be run better than the system that is running it now, is the DC Council?
Well, you know, it's so funny that you're so strange that you should say that, Marilia, because this just sounds absolutely crazy, but I believe it's true. If you look at banana republics, look at countries in the Caribbean which did not have control over their own destiny, countries that were run by outside governments. You see corruption all over the place, and you see inefficiencies all over the place. And no, I don't think that's so much different than the District of Columbia.
That's a very good point. And not just the Caribbean, but Central America, South America.
Yeah. And you see, you know, and it's one of the first things Tom Davis said last week on the show was about the corruption in D.C. And you know, Marion Barry was one of my favorite people in Washington politics. He was so good to me. He was such a great guy. I think of him as a wonderful person. But you know what? Every time I drive down to Anacostia, I say to myself, this man was in power for 40 years. What did he do for the people that elected him?
Right. You know?
Since I've been elected, we've had Harry Thomas go to jail. He's now running for an office in our delegation. We've had Michael Brown go to jail. We had Jack.
Not you, Evans. Of course. Michael A. Brown, right?
Michael A. Brown. We had Jack Evans. We had Kwame Brown. We've had there's a lot of corruption in D.C. government.
There really is.
And you know, and you're right, that is part of it. Because you know, we have so many talented people in this town, but we focus on national politics, and you can't run for Senate in you know, with a vote in a district or for Congress, and that makes a difference. When I was first elected, we gave the keys to the city to a guy who was an African American senator from Massachusetts named Ed Brooke.
Yep.
Brooke was a Washingtonian. He went to the Second World War, and he fought in a segregated unit. And he came back to Washington, and he wanted to get involved with politics. He wanted to make a change. And there was nothing to run for. There was no elected mayor. There was no elected school board. There were no elected offices of any sort. So he moved to Massachusetts, where he became a legend. He was a senator for many, many years, and several terms. And we gave him the keys to the city because he was the one that was our primary person in the Senate to get the D.C. Voting Rights Act, which would have given us two voting senators and a voting Congress. He got it through the Senate, and it wasn't ratified by the state, so it never became law. But yeah, we've lost so many talented people like Ed Brooke. I think a lot of the corruption and stuff that goes on in Washington is because we all focus on national politics. We don't focus on what's happening here.
I think that's right.
Well, my dear, we have come to the end of another show. I'm glad that we were able to get the Reverend on for some time. And, you know, we hope that we'll have an amazing guest again for you next week. I hope you have some fun things coming up in the week to a week ahead. You know, we're going to try to get another person on the show next week that will be an interesting guest, and we'll move forward. I appreciate you being on the show every week. You know that we try to send a song out at the end of the show. We dedicate it to the people that have been on the show. And today's song is from Sly and the Family Stone. It goes out to the Reverend and everybody in the Rainbow Coalition. Here's everyday people. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Mike. You're amazing. You bring such depth to this show.
Oh, come on.
You do. It's incredible.
I'm prepared to say things like that. See you.
See you.